This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Early on in my walks through the Scots Pinewoods of Abernethy, I began to notice the standing dead trees. They come in all shapes and sizes, barkless and pale amongst the deep greens of the living trees, pockmarked, riddled with the traces of beetles and beasties. Some retain their bark, some are lichen-covered. Over time, they will fracture their branches, sometimes shear half their trunks onto the forest floor. Such trees are known as snags, and when I investigated further, I found the deadwood in a Scots pine forest is incredibly important for the forest's health. These trees can stand for decades, decaying quietly, slowly, leaching a gradual and steady release of nutrients back into the forest's understory.
Artist and writer Amanda Thompson reading from her new book, Belonging. And it's the symbol of the snag which she weaves into her personal inquiry into themes of home, memory and identity.
They are home to a vast array of birds and insects, some very rare, specialist saproxylic species, including several types of beetles, wasps and hoverflies, and the lichens and fungi are dependent on these microhabitats. Ecological islands of otherness that dead and dying wood provides. Birds nest in their hollows and holes, and eat insects that feed on the dead wood. I love the idea that the dead can sustain the living, and it has become an important touchstone for me, how that which is no longer with us can make us who we are and can be a continuous source of strength and comfort.
I'm Helen Needham, and in this edition of Scotland Outdoors, I'm in conversation with Amanda Thompson. Amanda spends most of her time in Strathspey and writes in minute detail about her beloved Abernethy Forest, close to her home. But she also takes us back to where she grew up in Kilsyth, near Glasgow, and how she discovered how much her past, and especially the family history before she was even born, has helped to form who she is today. We met in a quietish corner of Edinburgh to chat, the place where she came to study as a young woman. And I'm sure many of you will relate to her descriptions of growing up in a small town and what that felt like.
I think there's countless towns like Kilsyth, just around Glasgow, quite small, mainly working class, at the time kind of probably predominantly full of council houses. It was the kind of place that you would just go out to play with people where you stayed, and you would go out and play all day and be back in time for tea. And there was nothing kind of high maintenance and nothing high tech about childhood. It was just a place where there was a lot of places that you could go out to, out on your bikes, you know, down to play tennis at the tennis courts, you know, go for walks and things like that. So I suppose when I started to think back about it, it really made me think actually I spent a lot of time in nature without thinking about spending a lot of time in nature. It was just the place where we went out and played and walked and sledged and picked blaberries and brambles and things like that. You know, it was just always this place of being outside actually for a lot of the time.
And what is the countryside like around there for people who've never been to Kilsyth?
It looks on to the Kilsyth Hills, which are a continuation of the Campsies, so quite kind of low rolling hills. There's lovely walks kind of through woodlands, I suppose. The Forth and Clyde Canal is really quite close to a place called Auchinstarrie, which is significant to me because it's where my papa grew up as a boy. So there's lovely kind of walks along the canal and kind of out to a place that we call the Dam, which is Banton Loch, which was a reservoir which was built to feed the canal. Nothing spectacular at the time, but when I go back now, because my mum's still in the same house as she was in when I grew up, it's actually quite lovely, actually, once you step outside the town.
You say that with an element of surprise in your voice.
Well, you know, I think anybody that grows up in a small town quite often wants to get out. And as you said, you know, I came to Edinburgh University and it felt very small and very contained, kind of in my teenage years. You know, I wanted something else and I wanted something more. So it was lovely to leave, but actually it's actually got a lot going for it.
Yeah, it's grown on you. What I observe from your writings is that you actually, as a child and young person, walked everywhere. Like your family, they walked everywhere. They went for donders, as you call
them. Yeah, or donors, yeah.
Donors.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have a car. You know, my mum worked in Kirkintilloch, you know, so she would take the bus, and we'd take the bus into town, as we call it, into Glasgow. But yeah, I mean, you know, now actually I was even thinking about probably walked a couple of miles up and down to school every day.
Without thinking about it.
Yeah, so walking was just something that we did, and we would go for walks as a family on Sunday afternoons, always after church. Probably could walk a good kind of 3-4 miles. You know, but it felt like at the time that was something everybody did, you know, on a Sunday afternoon.
It was a kind of ritual.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a lovely thing to do. And I suppose, thinking back, it was a time when, early on, there was no Sunday opening for shops or anything like that. There was probably only 4 or 3 TV channels. There was limited other things probably to be done at that time, maybe. I think it's funny looking back now, because I'm talking about the 70s and early 80s, but it does feel very much like a different era. When I was writing the book, I found that almost hard to believe how different it feels looking back to how it feels at the time to what my life is like now.
That way of life, that just wondering about walking everywhere just because that's how you got about, that did promote for you clearly a sense of connection with the outdoors and with the natural world as well.
Yeah, and I think just being able to be out and see and observe things. And I think probably my papa in particular would point out birds and point out plants and flowers and things like that. There's something about walking which helps you just start to notice change. And that idea of repetition and repeated walks is something I suppose I've kind of pulled into some of the work I make, some of the writing. It's about how you start to see change. And I think probably that idea of just repetition and what you see and see things differently has been something that maybe started in childhood.
That same Sunday walk, for example.
Yeah, yeah. There's a limit to the kind of walks you could do and where you could go, so it was always a variation kind of on a theme. And I still do them. You know, if I'm home, I'll go. My mum doesn't walk as far now, but we'll still go for walks, you know, and if, you know, if I'm there for Christmas, I'll kind of go along the canal or kind of up around the dam again. Or sometimes it doesn't feel that much changed. It's quite interesting. Sometimes it feels you can see that a lot's changed and there's a lot of new build in the town that there wasn't there when I grew up. So there's places where, yeah, I used to go sledging and roll my Easter eggs that are now just a new estate and things like that. So it feels like you have to walk a little bit longer to get into the countryside than you used to from where my mum stays. But you can still get there quite quickly.
Let's talk about the canal then, because that's a really significant place for you, or thoroughfare for you, because of the family connections.
Yeah. Yeah, so my papa, that's my mum's father, as a boy lived in the canal, and his father and grandfather were the blacksmith and lock keeper on the canal down at Auchinstarrie, just kind of, so it's about a couple of miles where we stay now. The canal, again, I think, has completely changed from when I was a child walking along. I think since the Millennium Project kind of opened up the canals a lot, so there's a lot more boats, and I think there's a marina there now and a pub. I think what's interesting about it is I don't really recall that many stories that my papa told me about his time there. He talks about, I think, the Gypsy Queen, which was a boat that used to kind of travel along, presumably from Falkirk to Glasgow, and passengers used to throw coins at the didn't throw coins at the children. For the children. I think it's always interesting when you go back and think, actually, 100 years ago, maybe my papa was walking along this spot. You know, I think there's always something interesting about when you start to think back about time.
Do you feel a sense of connection then when you put your mind in that place?
I don't know if it's connection or just kind of wondering about these people that haven't really been in my life for a long time. So, you know, I wonder what it must have been like for him. I wonder what he was like as a boy, what he was like as a man, actually, and as a young man, what he was like before he was my papa. It's interesting to have to think just in these kind of fragments and stories that are just that little bit removed from actual knowing, if that makes sense.
Do you think your interest in all of this is because of the stage of life that you're at?
Yes. You know, I'm in my 50s now, and you're very aware of change. I had a very good friend who died about 5 or 6 years ago, who was my age. And you start to think about, I think as you get older, you do start to think about your mortality, but then you also start to think about other people that you haven't seen for a while and realise, my gosh, it's been 40 years since I saw that person, or since that person was in my life, you know? And then when, I mean, it was kind of, I suppose, happenstance, when you start to look at family photographs, then you also start to think about, oh, who was that person? How did that person relate to this person? You know, did they get on? Did they not get on? What's the story behind this? So I think there is this idea of trying to think back about these people who maybe weren't necessarily exceptional in the sense of how they were in the world, but they were exceptional to us, you know? And actually, I think for good or bad, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, my grandparents and my family, like, for good. And I know there's other people that will think back to their kind of family and think, not think kindly on who people are or what they were. But all of the things in our past affect who we are now.
And that leads me on nicely, because actually this is all written within the context of your very detailed observations of the natural world around you as an adult, really, because you're also fascinated by words, having written the Scots Dictionary of Nature. Mm-hmm. So that features a lot throughout. Snags.
Yes.
That's quite a symbol, isn't it, that the past actually feeds into the present and the future. It has a significant role to play.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, in so many ways. And I suppose the idea of the snag has been the kind of metaphor that I've carried with me when I started to look at and think about my family and my history. But also I think ideas of home and what makes a home, how we actually have these snags all over Scotland. If we look, we have the clearance villages. We've got the Finnison Crane, for example. We've got standing stones. We have all these things that if we stop and look at them, they remind us of what was here before. Here we are in Dunbar's Close. And, you know, this is a really kind of, it's an example of what a medieval garden,
yeah,
perhaps.
So, yeah.
You know, and walking down the Royal Mile, if we pause and look, we can see just this history which is right there before our eyes if we stop and look and pay attention.
And then what does that evoke within you when you do that?
There's something about a rootedness which it can give you, and it gives me that sense of continuity, which I think is a really important thing to have, and I think a connectivity to place that is quite easy just to skim the surface. And I think I really enjoy and have enjoyed, and again, this is maybe something we're getting older, just actually slowing down and how important it is to slow down and take stock of your surroundings. And that's what I do. You know, that's why I've always loved bird watching, because it's an excuse to stop and just look and listen to what's around.
Well, we've talked about Kilsyth, where you grew up, and you still clearly have connections to that place, but actually you have chosen to make your home very close to Abernethy Forest.
I can't quite remember not knowing the place, but certainly when I came to do a PhD, it became about Abernethy Forest, which was just wonderful, and that helped me spend a lot of time and seeing it in different seasons at different times and through different people's eyes. And that really kind of, I suppose, kick-started my interest in the place and love of the place.
Do you feel that you've found somewhere that suits you, somewhere that you feel connected to in Abernethy Forest?
Absolutely. I absolutely love it. Although I've just been on holiday. I just came back on Monday from the Outer Hebrides, and I absolutely love North Uist, so
which is completely different in terms of landscape, isn't it?
It's completely different. Do you know, I think I just love Scotland, actually. I think we are incredibly lucky to live in a place like this. There's so many different, beautiful, beautiful parts of it. You know, I think if I lived in the Outer Hebrides, I would miss the Cairngorms and Abernethy Forest, the light, the waves, the birds, and the Outer Hebrides is just incredible as well.
Let's go back to Abernethy Forest, because it is a pristine example, really, isn't it, of Caledonian pine forest. It's a very celebrated and cherished habitat, which I suppose gives us some kind of indication of how things might have been a long time ago.
There's a lovely book kind of written about the Scots pine forest in the 1950s by Stevens and Carlyle, and they have a lovely quote which I always kind of go back to, which is, to stand in them is to feel the past. You know, and you have this real feeling of longevity and continuity in these forests, even though a lot of the trees have been planted, even though a lot of them aren't that old. There's something just about that, the space of them, and also, you know, the plants and flowers and birds and animals that are there. Do you know, there's capercaillie, of course, and strathspeys, the kind of, I think, the last stronghold in Scotland for the capercaillie, crossbills and crested tits. There's pine martens, there's red squirrels, the ospreys are back in Lochgarten again. Phenomenal numbers of rare and endangered species of lichens and mosses and things like that are there as well. So it's just an incredibly beautiful, valuable place that we have. You know, it's an incredibly important place and an absolutely, absolutely beautiful.
It's a rich habitat. You, because we should point out, are an artist as well. So you've used Abernethy Forest as a sort of muse or a place to create art within and from. I was interested in your sort of mapping of the forest through your own meanderings.
Yeah. I make what I call walk drawings, which is to stick on a GPS and just mark the walks that I make from my house. It started when I was doing my doctorate, when I was shadowing foresters and ecologists as they went about what they were doing, because if you're a forester or you're an ecologist and you're doing a particular piece of work which might involve walking transects or things like that, you have to walk it in a particular way, which is very different from just sticking to tracks. So I was really interested in how you could almost draw through walking. What I've done, and especially since lockdown, is just carry a GPS with me a lot of the time when I start off walking from my house, and just make these kind of walks that overlap or don't overlap, and you can see kind of where the tracks are, but sometimes I go away off, you know, looking for a bird or a flower or things like that. And again, actually, just kind of recording where I've been to just have that record of movement.
And what are some of the shapes like then, the resulting shapes of your walking?
I think I'm amazed at how much walking I do, because obviously if you're walking a line and walking a line and walking a line, it just, the line gets thicker and thicker and darker and darker and darker. It's kind of quite nice to see how your house is just this little centre, you know, this is the centre of your world, and then where else you go. And of course during lockdown we were very limited about where we could go, so we had, it was almost like a kind of walking circles around the house every day. So it was really nice just to see how these walks gathered and see actually where favourite spots
that you were just naturally drawn to.
Naturally drawn to. Yeah, so there's a walk across the track and up a field, which just gives wonderful views over to Beinachmore and a little bit of the Cairngorm. So it's always kind of from the top of that hill you can see where the first snows are. There's other tracks that you think, well, I know why I went there, because I was looking for Twinfler, for example. I couldn't necessarily say I had favourite tracks, actually, but they all have this kind of cumulative effect of just loveliness in the forest and things to see.
Like you said, you spend time with ecologists and so on, going out with them and just witnessing what they're doing and being part of, when they perceive the forest in a completely different way, don't they? And move around the forest in a completely different way. And you actually found yourself that you didn't recognise somewhere that was actually quite familiar to you.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It was partly because the first time I'd been there, I didn't really know the forest at all. And the second time or third time I was there, it was on a path I'd walked a couple of times before, but it was because when I'd walked with the ecologist, we'd approached it from a completely different angle. And the view was completely different, but also the weather and the time and the company was very different as well. So it was a little Lochan that I'd arrived at one summer, and because I didn't really know the area well, I'd kind of looked at a map and thought, well, here's a tiny Lochan, I wonder if there's a diver on it. So I'd taken this walk to this Lochan, which was quite remote, and of course there wasn't a diver, but it had felt so far away, and that walk that I'd taken on my own, that it never would have occurred to me that I would have got to it pretty easily from another direction with the ecologist. So, and of course it was winter when I was walking with the ecologist. So, yeah, it was really interesting. Just that almost shock of recognition was really kind of really took me aback.
And that's the thing about being in the forest, though, isn't it? Because your perception is different because of the trees and because there's so much cover as well.
Absolutely, and because it's pine woods, it's not like you notice. I mean, you do notice a difference between summer and winter because of the understory, but in a sense, the trees themselves don't necessarily change that much. They do, but again, you have that sense of continuity through the season as well. And also, you don't, when you're in the middle of the forest, you don't get the vistas out, which also help route you and kind of tell you where you are.
Seasonality is something as well that is significant within all of this, and the changing seasons. And I think we all, during the lockdown, became much more aware of the changes that have been happening for goodness knows how long that we maybe never noticed before.
Just having that time during lockdown just to be in the same place and notice, I think, was incredibly important for a lot of people, because quite often, I think, in our lives, we are out and about and running to work or running and, you know, getting our messages or things like that. But we had this time, and I think I was incredibly, incredibly lucky to be in Strathspey during lockdown and be able to get out and just to notice these shifts and changes, and whether it was when the birds arrived or whether it was the first anemones of the year or celandines, you know. Again, I suppose I'm coming back to just being able to just slow down and look and observe was really really important to me, but also starting to think about just the pace of our lives and how, I think, potentially detrimental to health, kind of going at full pelt all the time potentially is. And I think there's a lot of us are just really realising how valuable that slow pace of things is. And you know, it did make me think about these Sunday walks I used to take with my grandparents when there wasn't really that much else to do, but how important just that slowing down and taking time actually is. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember if it was lockdown or the year before, the neighbour said, oh yeah, the cuckoos, they come back on the 24th, you first hear a cuckoo on the 24th. And on that year, April? 24th of April. And on the 24th of April that year, we heard a cuckoo. You know, it was remarkable.
Bang on time.
Bang on time. But I'd taken a note of the year before, and it was the 27th of the first time that I heard a cuckoo. And this year I didn't hear a cuckoo till the beginning of May. I don't know if they did arrive late. I don't know if there's fewer of them. But I'm interested to know when I'll hear a cuckoo next year, for example. You know, similarly with swallows, like...
When did they arrive for you this year?
Oh, now you're asking.
April.
They felt later as well.
I felt ours were later this year too.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel that there are as many of them.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'm interested to know if that's just a personal kind of observation or whether it's something that other people have experienced as well. And I think almost having that, it's not quite citizen science, but it's almost citizen noticing.
Yeah.
Citizen noticing. That to me is really interesting, and how we start to put together whether the seasons are changing, whether it's a one-off, or whether, you know, whether this is something that is shifting and changing year by year.
And that just gives sort of longer term sense of observation and connection with the natural world too, not just that, oh, noticing things as you go. It's more of a commitment, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to go anywhere apart from your own head or your family's head. Or like, we have a notebook in the house where we just kind of write down when we first see things in the year and the last things of the year. And it is really interesting just to go back and reflect on. In fact, I was speaking to somebody yesterday who is down in Oxfordshire, and he was talking about how they've just had an influx of painted ladies.
Oh.
And I said, I remember we had a lot one year, and I'm sure it was the first year of lockdown. So I don't think I've seen that butterfly since that year, but now I'm interested, and I'll look out for them now, because I think, well, if they're in Oxfordshire, well, maybe they are kind of coming further north, so maybe there'll be a point that we'll see them up here.
You're suddenly a bit more
keen
to
you've got an eye out for them now that you maybe hadn't had before.
I wanted to talk about language, because it hadn't really occurred to me before, but so many of these old Scots terms are related to the weather.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Because there's a lot of weather in Scotland. In days gone by, we had to pay more attention to it. I think Kathleen Jamie said this lovely thing once, and I'm paraphrasing, so I hope it's not wrong, that all writing before the 20th century was nature writing. Do you know?
Like, yes, I think she did say that, yeah.
And at the time that the old dictionaries were, the kind of 19th century dictionaries were being compiled, everybody was in nature. You know, we had to pay attention to the weather. We had to know its nuances. We had to kind of understand, you know, whether you were a fisherman or a woman out at sea, or you were a farmer, or you were just kind of walking. You had to kind of know what the weather was like and what it was going to be doing. And I love the kind of nuances of weather that you get. We just say it's rainy. We might say it's smirry or it's dreich. You know, but there's so many more words for weather that we used to use. Ouchin means to sigh or blow gently. A stour is a stiff breeze. A caver is a gentle breeze that moves the water slightly. I love lumming, which means it's pouring down. Dunfo, a heavy fall of snow. Heavy-hearted means used of the atmosphere, lowering and threatening rain. A sapless day means it's rainless and dry. So I like that, it's sap, sapless. Do you know, isn't that lovely? Tunyatar, to rain slightly with a high wind. A landlash is a great fall of rain accompanied by a heavy wind. In Gloucestery, a day in which there is rain accompanied with a pretty strong wind. And I love how there's some of these words that are, even if you didn't know the definition or you'd never heard the word before, if I was to say, oh, it's a Gloucestery day, I'm sure you would
kind of get a sense.
You'd get a sense of it. Same with a splutery day. You know it's not going to be dry if it's a splutery day.
How would you describe today then?
Well, do you know, there's not that many words for sunny days.
Because it doesn't happen very often. It's been a bit wet.
Has there been any skeetles?
Skeetles?
A small shower?
Yes, there's been a few skeetles earlier. What is the purpose for you to share these words, these old words?
There's a lovely poetry to them. Even if they're dictionary definitions, there's a lovely feeling and atmosphere to them that I think are just lovely. So I keep going back to them. But also, again, it's that idea of slowing down and pausing and really thinking about the details, you know. So it's not just rain, it's a particular kind of rain. It's not just wind, it's a particular kind of wind. I always think about my practice or like what it is to have a slow art, which it is. And I think what I like as well is that sometimes you can, all you want to be and have is just to be in that place, and that's absolutely enough. It doesn't have to become anything else apart from just the experience of being there and experiencing something. So I like that idea of not having to always think, I am now going to make something about this. It's now going to be a piece of writing, or it's now going to be a piece of work. There's something just about taking the time for yourself just to be here.
Amanda Thompson there, and Amanda's new book Belonging is published by Canongate and is out now. Please do get in touch and tell us where you listen to this podcast. Genuinely, we love to hear from you wherever you are in the world. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And if you're interested in knowing about the music, as I know some of you are, that was Forest by Ross Ainslie. I'm Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.